How many times has this happened to you? You said, what I need is a great podcast on books. Well, it's here. Chatter on Books, and it starts right now. I'm Jamie McIntyre, your part-time announcer, and here's your full-time host, Tori Clark.
Welcome back, everybody, to Chatter on Books. Hope you're all doing well and staying healthy. I have awesome antibodies, so fingers crossed for a while. In just a little bit, we are going to be talking to Nebo, who's this incredible author, with one of the most entrancing books I've read in a long time, which I picked up because Ron Charles of the Washington Post called it one of his favorite books of the year. It is The Chosen and the Beautiful. It's an insult to this book to say it's an adaptation or an addition to The Great Gatsby, but we'll talk about that. And speaking of Ron Charles, we are joined by him tonight. Ron, thanks for coming back. How are you, my friend?
I am so glad to be here because I loved that novel and I've been dying to meet the author. So this is a very happy night for me.
Yes. What did your email when I sent Ron Nima going, hey, because of you, we've got Nebo on the show. Would you consider joining us as a panelist? And he says, I would break into your house to talk to Nebo. So that's the most enthusiastic response we ever got. We have a very busy show tonight, but one of these shows soon, I'm going to talk about authors, and they are Washington, D.C. based authors who in years past have asked me for a lot. And then when I ask them to be on the show, they have some munchkin send me the most insulting email ever. So we'll talk about that.
Are you going to name the names?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Better be naming names.
Absolutely. Last week, I trashed Bob Woodward. Wow. And because I have no career left, so I trashed Bob Woodward. David was very appropriate and very careful. I noticed the next day that Elsa Walsh, who was Bob's spectacular significant other, spectacular woman.
Yes.
Was following us on Twitter. So I'm a little worried. Maybe she listened.
She retweeted.
She retweeted. Yeah.
Yes.
I think she thought I would say nice things.
It was mostly complimentary.
Mostly. Yeah. Okay. Claude's doing all the important work that the dulcet tones of David Aldridge just heard. David, very quickly, did you watch the Ryder Cup? Did you have time to watch the Ryder Cup and watch Rory McIlroy cry?
No, I'm not a Ryder Cup person, Tori. It's not my thing.
I know golf isn't your thing, but if you're not going to do golf, do the Ryder Cup.
I know. I'm sure it's. I get the majesty of it and the pseudo jingoistic kind of thing goes on that I'm not quite down with. So I'm not really into like the Ryder Cup or the Davis Cup and tennis and things like that, where it's just all USA, USA. I'm getting heckled by my partner here, who's a big tennis buff. She loves Davis Cup. I know I should love it, but I don't.
You should. Okay, Claude, tell David why we should love the Ryder Cup.
Yeah, so I wish I could. The problem is, as much as I love golf, I hate the Ryder Cup and I hate the team defense. It's such an international sport anyway. All of a sudden, separating these guys in this, it just doesn't do anything for me. And I didn't watch a single second of anything. Oh. I didn't even pay attention to it. Well, apparently, I mean, the USA won, so that's good, right?
First time in a long time. Yeah. And they did it with a bunch of new faces.
Mm-hmm.
The most entertaining thing, and I'm killing time here a little bit because in a couple minutes we're going to be talking to this interesting guy, Brad Meltzer. But the PGA, as we discussed, and I can't remember if we discussed this on the podcast or off the podcast. And Ron, I know you are right on top of this because you followed the Formula One series on Netflix, right? Religiously, right? I vaguely remember you reviewed Lewis Hamilton's autobiography. But this Formula One series on Netflix, which these guys know, is just spectacular. And it has done for Formula One the most amazing things. So, Claude, the PGA is working with Netflix to try to do a similar thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to work. It's not going to work.
We did talk about this, but you'd have to be a Patreon member to hear it. And then you go to patreon.com/chatteronbooks.
Excellent plug. Our
breakdown of this thing.
Excellent plug. To your earlier suggestions, watching a bunch of – they aren't middle-aged, but they look like middle-aged white guys schlumping around – a beautiful course is just not the same as these incredibly hot cosmopolitan drivers going 200 miles an hour. It's just,
I think Bryson DeChambeau said this and he said 51 weeks out of the year, you guys want me to only care about myself and my game and my fitness and my winning. And if I don't win, I get killed for it. And then you want me to turn around and all be about, it's not about me. It's about us and country and all that. And he's like, that's stupid.
Yeah, and Bruce Koepka said a similar thing. Bruce Koepka said, listen, this is not a team thing. I got my own routine. I do my own thing. I've got teammates. And I gotta rely on someone else. It's just not.
You guys are so cranky. That's how it is. Okay, so then just don't join the Ryder Cup team. Don't do it. Okay. There are many others.
I won't.
Okay. Okay. Joining us right now, and this is seldom are we newsworthy on Chatter on Books or even closely connected to the news, but we are, and we are now joined by Brad Meltzer. Brad, how are you?
I'm good. How you doing?
Good to see you. Okay, because as anybody who, the three people who listen to the show know, I can make everything about me. You and I have a mutual friend, Lorraine. You know her as Lorraine Bowles. Since I've known her before 1980, Lori Bowles, she helped you out with your first couple of great best-selling adult books, correct?
She did. How do you know her?
She and I went to school together. We were ill-fated students in the journalism school of GW, which was a disaster.
And I thought it was going to take more than 1 second to make this feel like Washington, D.C., but it immediately.
Really? Because if there is one strong genetic preponderance in Washington, D.C., it is make it about me. But
no, it's about make it about, like, everyone knows everyone and the incestuous nature of that town. So thank you for doing it. You set the record. I thought no one can do it in less than 1 second. You have done it. It's a miracle.
Thank you. I practice a lot. Okay, Brad is with us. And Ron, you're on point here for this segment. Brad is with us. Because I know Brad, and I've read many of Brad's best-selling, New York Times best-selling books, adult thrillers. I think Book of Lies might be my favorite, Brad. And we want you to come back another time as our featured author. But right now we're talking because Ron, last week was banned book weeks, or the American Library Association puts out the list of the most banned books, correct?
Right. Yeah, every year. They've been doing it for many years. In the last few years, it's always been books about LGBTQ people, pretty much, that dominated that list. But then this year, we're seeing a real sudden shift toward books about police brutality, racial issues, Black Lives Matter. Those are the books that are getting challenged. And that's where Brad comes in, I think.
Okay, before we come back to Brad, but I have to read the headline of your newsletter last week, which is spectacular. Everyone should subscribe to Ron's newsletter. For Banned Books Week, I read the country's 10 most challenged books. The gay penguins did not corrupt me.
Yeah, somehow I slipped through. Yeah,
so spectacular. Okay, Brad.
And hi, Ron, who I know as well, because we all know each other. I know, it's silly.
We all know each other.
See you, Brad.
So, Brad, tell us what happened with your wonderful children's books about Rosa Parks and Martin Luther King.
Yeah, so I think it came through Twitter, of course, because everything awful comes through Twitter. And someone says they banned your book on Rosa Parks. And I'm thinking that can't be right. Right. Like, I know that anything can be banned. My friend's book, I Am Jazz, Ron, as you mentioned, is one of the most banned books because it's about a transgender girl. It's a gimme every year.
Well, it's about jazz, Brad. Let me interrupt. It's about jazz. David and I will just stop you on jazz.
But... Yes, exactly.
I love jazz. You are just.
And you, and the book is spectacular. But I will say, when they said they banned Rosa Parks, I'm like, well, that was a mistake, but it wasn't. And what happened was a school board, the Central York School District in Pennsylvania, they made a list. There was a diversity list made by a diversity committee and librarians and teachers that said, here are good books to teach race to your kids, which is, of course, a good thing. The school board says, we'll take that list. We want to vet this list first just to make sure we're giving our kids is appropriate. Again, to me, not a bad thing. You don't want to just give any book to kids, especially when you're in that position of power and you're elected. The problem is that was last October. They sat on it for a year and they did it purposely. Let's be honest. None of these books takes more than 10 minutes to read. It's not like we said, here are the 150 biggest novels and it's going to take you a year to blow through them all. And what they were doing was kind of sending a message. And I think that, you know, some of the people on the board were, you know, maybe we shouldn't have done that, but there were people on the board that were clearly using words like indoctrination, and we don't want them indoctrinating our children, which is always the code word that you see, whether they're going after someone who's Black, someone who's Jewish, someone who's gay, someone, whatever it might be. The word indoctrination is a useful term for the other side. So I think to myself, well, we have to do the immediate thing that Rosa Parks teaches us all to do, which is protest. I found these two amazing activists in York, PA, who were running Little Free Libraries, who quickly found me on Twitter.
Not everybody knows Little Free Libraries.
Little Free Libraries like those little tree houses you'll see in people's front yards, and it says take a free book if you want one. Yeah. They're in really good communities. If you don't have one, you can request them. I encourage people, if you want to put one in, there's places you can just put in how to get a Little Free Library. People will send them to you. And they're just a beautiful way to kind of make a library grow, especially in small communities where there might not be the libraries you want near you. And these two women said, we will stock the books. I said, you make your wish list. One of them did Amazon because they know it's easy. And one of them did independent bookselling because we've got to support the independent stores. And I went out and just said, you know, I don't think there are many good things by having a good social media following, but one of the really good ones is you can put the word out and shame people when it comes to doing something like this. And I just said, everyone, listen, don't just buy our book on Rosa Parks. Go buy every book on this list.
Do you remember, Brad, some of the other books? It was Malala.
Of course, these were very controversial books.
Very controversial books.
Malala's autobiography, Sonia Sotomayor, I Am Enough, which is about empathy, right? This really controversial thing called empathy. They had Sesame Street was on there, How to Talk to Your Kids About Race, which means they're banning Big Bird and Grover.
Right.
Come on, right?
Well, there were no gay penguins on the suburfs, list.
Known suburfs is Grover.
Right. I mean, truly. The best part was a couple of days later, because we didn't even read the full list because they had different lists in different spots. So then they said, they didn't just ban our book, I Am Rosa Parks, but they banned, and I'll show you, because don't these look like subversive text? They also banned I Am Martin Luther King Jr. I mean, this, nothing looks like it's more trying to corrupt your children than like Chris Eliopoulos' sweet, nice art. And the truth was, you know, as authors, I know my fellow authors here can attest, is you're always kind of like, obviously everyone's always trying to say, how do we get publicity? How do we get this? How do we get that? I just was like, I don't really care. We're just going to do our thing and protest.
And see what happens.
And suddenly we got Fox News calling us. Then we had CNN call us. Then we had the local newspapers calling us. And when Fox and CNN agree, you know you screwed up, right? You know you screwed up. And so they had me on each of them on to talk about it. The school board met on a week ago today, on Monday, and I got a call that basically said, hey, listen, there's a public comment period the first hour. You get 3 minutes to speak. Brad, will you come speak? When someone in the community asked me, I said, I will be there. They called on me first. I get up there.
You're in Florida, right?
I'm in Florida. They're obviously in Pennsylvania.
Yep.
So I Zoom on. It's all Zoom. They don't meet in person at all. So everyone's Zooming. And I log on and I said, you know what? This is obviously not my community, but I just want to read so you can see what you banned. And I read from I Am Rosa Parks. I read from I Am Martin Luther King. I read these really sweet, nice spots that basically say no one should ever be able to tell you're small or you're different or you're, you know, anything less than who you are. And I feel like I've done my job. I've indeed saved the day. And then I stop talking and all the community starts talking. And teachers chime in, mothers chime in. A member of the military says, I used to go to this high school and I'm embarrassed of you and my high school right now that you would do this as a school board. And I'm a major in the Army, or I forget his rank. And then the students started speaking with such passion that I sat there and I was like, I'm useless here. They did not need me at all.
What age group of students? I read about this, but what age group of students?
Yeah. So, you know, the funny part was, is because of the way the Zoom was, is they blanked the screen for anyone who was doing public comments. So we were only audio, because I think they're worried about in the community meetings like this, someone kind of taking off their shirt or embarrassed them or holding up something, you know, that they shouldn't.
That's,
so we're just black screen. So
yeah,
I think they were high school students. I can tell you tomorrow, because I'm going to meet with them tomorrow. They asked me if I would meet with them, and I said I would love to spend some time with them.
Good for you.
And so I'm meeting with them tomorrow, but I'll tell you that I was 100% useless. They were so impassioned. These students were so amazing, saying, you know what? I'm black and I can't find a book in my library now because of you. How dare you do that to me? And just speaking with such passion. By the time they were done and everyone was done speaking, the school board said, you know, we reverse unanimously our decision. We've unlocked and unfreeze this list. And again, full credit to the students. They were the stars for sure.
Wow. But that's amazing, especially in the world of the interweb and social media, that faced with actual facts and persuasive information and the right kind of emotion, they overturned their earlier decision. That's remarkable.
And shame. right? It's shame. Yeah, like, let's not turn them into suddenly amazingly wonderful people. You know, there were some who on right. there were like, some school board members on there were like, listen, I'm sorry, we shouldn't have done that. I didn't realize what we're doing. I didn't realize it fell behind. And you felt like actual, like, you know what? Everyone doesn't become evil in a moment because of something right. they did. And then there were some who spoke, and I wish I could remember their names because, again, they didn't put their names on the screen. You had to like listen to it because it was yeah. hard to tell who was who. But I remember a guy who very clearly on there was like, listen, I'm worried about you indoctrinating my children. I'm worried about these. And I'm like, I know who you are. And you're doing this because you know an election is coming soon in November and you're just trying to save your butt. And yeah. so you're gonna save yourself now. But, you know, I know exactly what you're doing. And that has to be called out and shine a light on it.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to bring Ron in the next second. But here's the app I want someone to develop. Here's the app. Is that when people are on the Zoom or whatever, or any kind of live interactive experience, and they use a big word like indoctrination, I want the app to go, eh! Before you get to say what you're about to say, you must define that word. Because I think people throw around the word the Constitution. They have no effing clue what they're talking about. What do you think, Brad?
I think when you're doing what they're trying to do, they love words like that. I mean, all of this is the code, right? There's a code that's being put right. out there in that moment.
But it's this emotional, visceral code. They don't actually understand the meaning of the word.
I think they understand the result, though. You know, they know what they're yeah, doing on that.
Right,
and
right.
I think the thing that's actually, I think, more disturbing to me is not going, hey, yes, we won. Let's ring our, you know, raise the flag. But I fear this is we're going to see only more of this. And I think, Ron, you were saying it before, you're only going to see, you know, they figured out in critical race theory
yep.
that this is a great wedge issue to scare people.
Yeah.
Right. This school board was terrified and paralyzed by their own fear.
Right.
Their fear that there's somehow some other that's taking over, and they're going to use critical race theory to make you feel like, oh my gosh, they're trying to do something to your children. And you know what? For as you said very wisely, when people don't understand all the meanings of what's going on and they hear they're doing something to your children, that just drives it is an unbelievably effective wedge, and you're going to see it more and more. And you know why? Because it's working. It's working. There are people right. out there who are scared. And when fear takes over, and listen, race is a hard issue, right? I'm a white man talking about race for Rosa Parks and Dr. King. Race is a hard issue for anyone to speak of, right. much less me. But I tell my kids all the time, you don't avoid things because they're hard. And when you don't talk about race, you're doing your kids a huge disservice.
But, you know, now there are all these states, most of them in the South, that have passed these laws specifically outlawing critical race theory in schools, whatever that is. And right. now you've got all these teachers and administrators who have to worry about being individually fined and disciplined if they cross one of these vague, you know, rushed laws that were passed this summer. So there's going to be a lot of self-censorship going on in the schools now, where teachers just don't think it's worth the trouble.
That's right, Ron. That's what they did here, right? It's not that they said, well, we didn't ban the books. We just froze the list.
Yeah.
Exactly. But what happens is librarians are like, can I use this? Can I not? Am I going to lose my job if I do? Am I not?
Right.
Like,
right.
And that little bit of confusion and just in the economy we're in and where we are is just enough to make people scared enough. And again, use that fear against people. We're going to see it more and more and more.
Right. And for every district where, you know, a bestseller like Brad comes in and gets a lot of publicity, there are many, many more little districts where these things just pass without any attention, without any interruption. And these books for queer kids and Black kids are just dropped from the library and nobody notices.
Yeah. And listen, you're so right, because I'm now getting all those emails. All these people are writing to me saying, look what's happening in my district. Look what's happening in mine. The reason that York screwed up so badly, it's not because of me. It's because they banned Rosa Parks. They banned Dr. King. They happen to ban right. two people that America actually agrees on. And that's why Fox News had me on. That's why CNN had me on. Right? It's like they screwed up.
Yeah.
Right? It had nothing to do with me or my following of people on the internet. It simply had to do with like, you went too far. You messed up that one. But it's, you know what? This small book here about gay and lesbian rights, or the small book here about, you know, race relations, good luck in trying to get that one going.
Right. Yeah, I'm afraid so.
You really feel that way, Ron?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Are there any authors like Brad, though, that you know of that have taken on the challenge and said, okay, I'm not going to just sit back and take this. I'm going to fight it and use social media to our advantage.
There are big YA authors who get involved in this fight every year. Yeah. And they use their social media following to try and help. But, you know, it's just, there are thousands of school districts all over the country. And I was talking to the head of the ALA office that handles this stuff. And he says, you know, it's in those small Midwestern libraries where the real harm is done, where you've got some lonely kid who doesn't understand what's happening to him, and he can't find any books that help him understand what he's going through.
Way back when, the beginning of Chatter on Books, and David remembers this, Claude probably remembers it, Michael Kornheiser, talked about how books were the safe place.
Right.
Especially for kids in that kind of middle school, getting into high school category. Books were the safe place where if you didn't know what you were thinking, what you were experiencing, you're working your identity, that was the safe place. And it's in all these communities.
They don't have access to the internet. They certainly don't have credit cards to buy their own books. I mean, what's in the library is pretty much all they've got.
Yeah. Listen, that's where I grew up. I mean, I didn't have money growing up. There were no books in my house, not one. Like my mom read the Star and the Inquirer. My dad read the Sports Page. That was it. But my grandmother had this magical object, you know, more powerful than Harry Potter's wand. She had a library card. And I remember going to the Brooklyn Library in our old neighborhood. And I remember going into that library and the librarian saying, oh, this is your section. And I literally thought she meant, these are your books. And it was there that I mean, for someone who grows up without money, books are the only way to experience the world and different ideas. It just is. I was the first in my family to go to a four-year college. My parents didn't know what to do with me, but it was books where suddenly there was this place to explore and be out there and find something that was counter to everything else you might be hearing. So, you know, again, that's why it hits me here, not because, oh my gosh, I'm worried. You know, if anything, they do us a favor in sales by banning it. That's not, but what hits me is those kids out there that I know are just like me and can't experience that moment that I had all those years ago.
Yeah. Okay, Brad, we got to let you go in a second, I know. But what's next? In your series for kids, you've got Oprah coming up.
We got Oprah coming up. And then we're doing, truthfully, we saw so much Muslim hatred over the past few years. So we use our books to fight back. So we were just like, fine, you want to hate on Muslims? We're doing Malala and we're doing Muhammad Ali. We're going to do a double Muslim kids books. And so we've just been really... we've been working on these books for 2 years, and whatever you really saw, we're doing I Am Pei, which we actually did. That's been done for 2 years. It just got delayed, but even before everything happened with Asian hate, but we just were like, we had so many kids writing to us and saying, you did someone who's Black, you did someone who's white, you did someone who's Indian, you did Native American, but where's an Asian American hero? So we're doing I Am Pei, and we just announced Dolly Parton. So that's fun. And then the biggest thing by far is the new thriller comes out in March called The Lightning Rod.
Okay, give us a hint of Lightning Rod and it'll let you go.
The Lightning Rod is basically a follow-up to The Escape Artist. It follows Zig and Nola. It's funny, I don't know how to pitch it yet. I don't want to ruin it. I feel like when my first instinct is say, and then they blank, and I'm like, that will ruin a really good part. but I'll say it's a bigger, deeper dive into the characters than I've ever taken. And I just love these characters. So it's their next adventure.
Excellent. All right, Brad Meltzer, thank you so much for joining us, especially on short notice.
Yeah, no, thank you. Thank you, Ron. Good to see you all again. Thanks, everybody.
And come back, okay?
I would love it. Thank you. Appreciate it. Thanks for what you do for books. Care. It's important.
All right. Are we ready? Ron, are you ready?
Yes.
Are you ready to metaphorically break through the front door of my house so you can talk to me?
I was thinking, you know, she should be involved in this discussion about banned books because that book should be taught in high schools along with The Great Gatsby. But she's going to run into problems because of certain issues having to do mostly with sexuality, I think. But I'd love to hear her thoughts about that, too, because my wife is already using or planning to use the first one of the chapters because she teaches The Great Gatsby every year. And she wants to use, well, anyhow, I'm talking too much and too fast.
No, you're not talking too much too fast. I mean, that speaks to the awesomeness and the complexity of the book, The Chosen and the Beautiful. Nebo, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, hello. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, my God. It's nice to see you. It's nice to meet you, even by Zoom. I have to read a great little bio I've read of you, and it was in the Uncanny magazine. I might be one of the few people who knows what Uncanny magazine is. Quote, she's a writer by trade, a storyteller by nature, a volunteer by inclination, and a dreamer by design. So before we get into your awesome book, is storytelling something you've done since you were a very small child?
I think that's part of the diaspora experience. We all tell stories. If you came from a place and you're someplace new, the first thing your family teaches you to do is to tell stories. Where you've been, where you're going, where the hell have you been, which is a little different. But yeah, no, storytelling is how I get through the world and how I help others get through the world and how I keep track of where I've been.
Okay, but 5 years old, what did you want to be? It's my favorite. What did you think you were going to be when you were five?
Okay, I caught a really unfortunate glimpse of the Clan of the Cave Bear movie, and the answer was a cave woman.
Nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong. If you like skins, you know, and things like that, there's nothing wrong with that.
I can't take care of my cat. I can't domesticate anything, you know. That's not in my skill set.
I see you're wearing leopard now.
I think that, yeah, there we go.
I can pretend that, yeah. Okay, so I read that writing short stories is your native language, quote unquote. And you've had some fabulous ones. What made you decide to tackle a novel? We'll get to the awesomeness of tackling, making better, in my words, The Great Gatsby. But talk about short stories being your native language.
Well, the wonderful thing about short stories is that they're short. They take so little time to write, and you can pack as much world into 5,000 words as you know how, and it turns out wonderfully. And people can consume it in a bite, and then they're not angry with you because they had to spend like a full day with you, I think. Speaking perfectly honestly, though, the transition from short stories to novels came about because I suddenly just realized I could, you know, from school, we're taught to write 500 words, 2,000 words, 5,000 words. And then suddenly, you know, at some point you get the idea, wait, a novel is 80,000 words or 120,000. And you're like, that's a lot, until you realize, wait, those are just words placed one after the other. That's all they are.
and then it just
comes together, and you're like, I can just keep putting words on top of other words, and it becomes a thing. And then eventually you do get done, which is wonderful, which is the best part.
Okay. I want to read a quote. You can tell me if this quote is true or not. Mm-hmm. There are some things I'm learning which need more space, but if you're willing to find just the right angle, just the right shot, you could fold an incredible amount of information into about 200 words.
Yes, of course.
Thank you. So was that the Chosen and Beautiful just putting a lot of 200 words together?
The writing of The Chosen and Beautiful was, it was something that was felt like it was very dreamlike. It was almost done like a collaboration with another work, obviously The Great Gatsby. And honestly, it was just words put after one after the other. It was written mostly chronologically, which is not usual for me. And it was written in 1,000 word a day chunks until I basically 1,000 words a day until I'm at the end, and then I'm done.
Wow. Okay, Ron Charles, I think some time ago when you were on this show, maybe when you were in my dining room, you told me that the Washington Post would get 300 books a day sent in unsolicited, saying, please review our books.
Not quite that many, about 150, about half that.
Only 150. Yeah. Okay, 150. My story is much better, 300.
Actually, so 7,000 books a day.
So this book comes across your desk that says, and Nevo, these are insults to your book because it's really remarkable, but adaptation, reimagination of, pick your word, of The Great Gatsby, comes across your desk. What's your first reaction, Ron Charles, Washington Post book critic?
I thought it sounded ridiculous.
Because? Ridiculous. Why?
I mean, vampires and witches and changing the point of view of this classic novel from somebody I'd never heard of. Who does she think she is fiddling with the canon of American literature with this ridiculous setup? It just sounded absurd to me.
Can I ask you a question? What does the word canon mean?
Oh, the accepted books of a particular field.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Go on. Continue.
But I'd been writing about the expiration of copyrights, and I'd been writing particularly The Great Gatsby. And there were some other Great Gatsby novels coming up.
Right.
And so I thought, well, you know, here's one of the first. It wasn't the first, but I think it was the second. So I thought, well, yeah, I'll just read it and see what it's like. And I was astonished at how great
it was.
Oh my gosh, I just loved it. But I've been terrible at telling people why they should read it. The minute I describe it, I can see them like back away from me. You know? Like,
puzzled.
Yeah, like what? I'm going to read that. It sounds horrible.
You do get a little giddy, which is very un-Ron Charles-like, and you lose all the words that you book critics use and this, that, whatever. Okay, Nee, what were you thinking What were you thinking? You are a very smart, very educated, very worldly person.
That's news to me.
Well, no, what were you thinking when you decide I'm going to write my first novel? I'm going to tackle one of the biggest, some would argue one of the best, but I'm going to tackle one of the biggest novels out there. What were you thinking that you were going to improve upon, my words, not Ron's, The Great Gatsby?
It's a very, very big person just walked by you there, Tor.
Who was it?
I hope it was your husband. I hope it was your husband.
Oh, yeah, he's feeding the dogs. Feeding the dogs.
Well, I was thinking a lot of things. Among them, you know, I would like to, you know, I'd like to write a novel, among other things. But first off, I was thinking I was an American. And they said that this was the great American story, so it belongs to me.
Wow.
Yeah. That's the beginning and the end of it. Although I think my agent might have a slightly different story from how she first heard me pitch it. So
how did she first hear you pitch it?
I was in the middle of writing this other book about a girl that was raised by ghosts, which is still at the halfway point, and I would like to very much to go back to someday. It sounds really cool. And she asked me, hey, is there anything else you're working on? And I said, oh, well, there's this other thing I've had in my head since I was basically a sophomore in high school. And I more or less outlined the novel that would become The Chosen and the Beautiful to her. And the minute, you know, I say that, there's this really long pause on the other end of the line. And Diana Fox, who's my agent, who's, you know, she's whip smart, just an amazing professional. And I'm just thinking, cool, she's going to fire me. And then I hear her say, kind of strangled, she's like, Nee, I'd like you to stop writing what you're writing, and I'd like you to write this instead. And, you know, because I more or less do mostly what my agent tells me, I said, okay. And about 5 months later, she had the first draft for Chosen the Beautiful in her hands, and that's how it went.
Ron, how often have you heard that story?
I've not heard that story. That's remarkably fast, too, because not only does she constantly weave her own novel through the text of The Great Gatsby, but she elaborates on it in a way that is really expansive and beautiful. Like she picks up Fitzgerald's language and then extends it in her own voice. And, you know, she's turned the whole book to the point of view of a Vietnamese Jordan Baker. That's the young woman, the golfer that Nick is dating. And then given it this fantasy overcast, I guess you'd call it. So it's very, very inventive and daring.
You called it jazzier than the original, quote unquote.
It is.
And Ron doesn't pick words without reason.
Well, I read The Great Gatsby many times because I was an English teacher for a long time. My wife reads it every year with her students. She's a high school English teacher now. So we both know this book probably too well. And to find someone who could breathe life into it and make us re-see those scenes in a way we'd never imagined, we just thought it was remarkable. She's sitting right here. That's why I keep looking over there.
Keep pointing over there. Okay, we're going to have her on the next show. Because often, Ron, you're referring to your wife. Okay, Nee, tell us about Jordan. And most people know, if people have read The Great Gatsby, they know about Jordan. But talk about Jordan and why you chose her to come up with this 21st century version of the theories and the themes that we know of The Great Gatsby.
The first thing I realized about Jordan when I did my reread to write this book, and honestly, back when I first read it as, you know, a teenage kid, the first thing I realized is that the story does not run without Jordan. Jordan is an integral part of the machinery of the story, but at the very bottom of it, she's actually just a piece of machinery. She does things that make absolutely no sense if you're actually standing in her skin and in her shoes. It's the biggest example is if you're best friends with a woman and you have, and you're, are you really going to surprise her with a meeting with the long lost love of her life out of the blue? Is that something you would really do? You're either stone cold evil, Or you have your own agenda going on. And the thing is, as written, from the point of view of Nick, this just all passes. But from the point of view of someone who is wondering what is going on with Jordan, what is the internal life of the other characters in the book, it doesn't fly. So once you start sticking a pry bar into who Jordan is and what she is, there are a lot more questions than answers. Fitzgerald, who I do not feel does anything by accident, he has packed a lot of work into 42,000 words, I believe. There's a lot going on with Jordan. She has her own past. There's a brief mention of the death of her father not long after Daisy is married. There's a lot going on there, and I've never really settled for myself until I got to write The Chosen and the Beautiful what it all meant. And that's why she became a very natural starting place for The Chosen and The Beautiful.
Awesome. Ron, how did this become so believable, so workable for you?
What I think is so clever is that she takes things we've often thought, like, gosh, Gatsby is kind of vampiric, and then makes him a vampire. Or Nick and Gatsby have a sort of strange relationship. Sometimes it seems almost sexual. So she makes it sexual. Or a little example. Everyone remembers that scene where Nick comes into Tom and Daisy's house, and Jordan and Daisy look so elegant there on the sofa that they seem to be floating. She has them floating. Gorgeous.
Was that what you were intending, Nee?
In terms of, excuse me?
The effect, in terms of what you wanted people like Ron Charles to see or experience in the book. Is that what you were intending?
I wanted to be a good time because, so we have The Great Gatsby. We have a story that is written in the 1920s. And for a lot of my sourcing comes from Maureen Corrigan's fantastic book, So We Read On. And in terms of what it was and what it was reflecting, the 1920s are huge. And we don't really get that in our modern memory of it. You know, it's 100 years ago. It's like, wow, women could only start wearing short skirts. And we're very impressed by that. But the thing about the 1920s is it was the world blown open. It was a new material culture. We were recovering from the twin traumas of the Spanish flu and World War I. And the world is new and brash. Electricity is everywhere. Advertising is making us realize how big the world is, and it could all be ours. And that's what I wanted to feed straight into The Chosen and Beautiful, how big it is and how magical it really was, even for the people who were just living in our normal version of it.
Very cool. Ron, are we going to experience the same kind of thing post-pandemic?
I don't know. We haven't got there yet. I'm starting to wonder if we'll ever get post-pandemic.
But you're getting all the pandemic books across your transom, right?
I am not seeing a lot of pandemic books yet. I'm getting a lot of climate apocalypse novels. I'm a little tired of that. But
I heard from a friend of mine recently who, I swear to God, wonderful person, 82 if she's a day, completely, totally depressed about the climate and global, and you know, good reason, but it's like, you know, you're not going to have to worry about it. We have to worry about it. My children, your grandchildren have to worry about it. Okay. Ron, I want you to sum up your review. One of the things you said in your review about Nebo's book, The Chosen and Beautiful, it's generated by her portrayal of Jordan as a queer Vietnamese American in a country growing increasingly racist and homophobic. The amateur reader of The Great Gatsby, and me, I apologize, I am the most amateur reader of books possible that could ever have a podcast about books, is The Great Gatsby was largely about class, and it kind of hinted at some other things. But right. Ron, does Nee's book bring those other things, race, homophobia, to the surface?
Whenever something is silenced in a book, that's an act. That's a conscious act. That's a thesis. What she does is notice those silences and make them loud. And suddenly we're talking about race. We're talking about immigration. All those things are in the novel by the way they are silenced. But she makes them the explicit subject of the book. I think it's really brilliant. And it makes me totally changes my impression of The Great Gatsby, too. It makes me read it differently.
Well, it makes me want to read it again. Because who wants to read something which is derivative of The Great Gatsby?
No, that is not
this
a problem.
This takes it to the next level, correct?
This is not a derivative novel. I know that's a common, okay. You would think that, but I did not have that impression.
Okay, Nee, did you get any hate mail from lovers of The Great Gatsby who just said, how dare you?
I got a lot of very deeply confused people. That was kind of fun.
Tell us, how were they confused?
None of it has topped my best bad review, which was a one star off of something I ghost wrote, which was, I thought this was another book with the same title, one star. And I'm like, okay, nothing's going to top that. No amount of swearing is ever going to top. I got a one star for someone else's book. So it's been pretty cool, actually.
Oh, that's great. But not too much. No, David, go.
May I ask a dumb question? Mm. I'm a reporter. That's what I do.
You got a mask hanging from your left ear.
I know,
really silly.
I know, because I have to wear a mask in this room. I am taking it off to do this podcast. All right. dumb question, Nee. What if someone's never read The Great Gatsby and they read your book?
Oh, that's a great question, David.
Yeah, I don't think that's a dumb question at all. They're going to find out that I put in more sex than Fitzgerald did. And speaking of it, never speaking of it, not being in YA. Yeah. I think they're going to have a good time with it, I hope. And I hope it won't be completely incomprehensible. And honestly, with everything I write, I just hope I gave them a good evening.
Yeah. That's what the book is just so, I just wonder, it stands on its own. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I don't think you necessarily have to read it through the prism of The Great Gatsby to enjoy it. You know what I mean? I mean, I suppose it helps on some level, but you don't have to, right?
You get more of the mean jokes that I put in if you read The Great Gatsby right before, actually. Gotcha. You do get more of those.
Did you write anything, Nee, where you thought to yourself, okay, this is going too far? Did you ever pull back?
The only moment where I thought I was going to pull back is there is this line where Nick and Gatsby meet for the first time at one of his parties, and Jordan is just watching them make eyes at each other. And she says very archly, so are we having a gay time now? And the funny part is that's from the original book.
Wow.
The thing that makes me feel really guilty is people think that I put that in there. I'm like, no, that's in the original. Please, that one's not me. that's been the most nerve wracking part.
So Ron, that's why I go to what's the opposite of derivative, Ron or David? Word
original.
People. Original. Yes, original. But that's part of the originality of Nee's book.
I heard echoes throughout the book. I mean, would you admit, not admit, would you say, would you agree that there are borrowed lines and phrases throughout the whole novel?
Absolutely. It's in print. I can't deny it now. It's far too late.
You're on the grid. You can't.
Oh, that's great.
What about the paper folding and the way those paper figures
Oh, the best.
Life? That's so cool. Where'd that come from?
So cool.
That one actually also comes from The Great Gatsby, as a matter of fact. So, okay, on page 2 of Gatsby, and the book's 100 years old. I don't have to spoiler it, do I?
No.
Okay. There's this part where Nick talks about one of his ancestors sending someone to fight in his place in the Civil War in a book that's only 40,000 words long. That means something. And I started thinking about the idea of paper sons, which is something that stems from Chinese immigration on the West Coast about a good 50 years before The Great Gatsby takes place. The idea of paper sons being that immigrants could only enter the United States if they were related to someone who's already living there. So there was a sort of a black market trade in bringing people in who were related, but not related to the extent that the United States government wanted them to be. So the idea of being a paper son, and then we sort of lead into one of the bigger plot points in The Chosen, the Beautiful, and the idea of paper and the idea of paper and, you know, in our world of papers meaning everything, papers please, you know, and the idea of artificiality and the line that I wrote and I just said, well, there it is, which is, well, it's real and it's paper. It's just real and made of paper.
Wow.
So reality and just echoing back to Fitzgerald's idea of appearances and reality.
That's
wow. Great. Ron, has anything like that ever come across your desk?
No, I can honestly say, and I've read, you know, thousands of books now and reviewed them. I've not read any book like this.
We should just end the show right there. Right there. But we won't, because we're going to make, from the sublime to the ridiculous, we're going to make Nevo do.
I also want to say that I love the book's deniability. Like sometimes I'd be like, well, is he a vampire? Is that a witch? Did that just happen? Is there a witch? Is that maybe I'm reading this? Maybe that's not, maybe, you know, maybe there's a logical explanation. I love the way she sort of rides along that, you know, blurry line between reality and fantasy. I think it was very, very disciplined.
This is the difference between Ron Charles and Tori Clark. I was just all in. I mean, and I'm just like immediately vampire. Absolutely. Right. Totally all in. All right. Nevo, this is spectacular. What's next? Can we ask you what's next? Are we allowed to ask?
Yeah, I have a book that is currently coming back in edits right now, which is what I'm calling 300 Years of Demons, Angels, Grief and City Planning, which I think is going to be a lot of fun for everyone. At some point, I'm hoping to get to do a sequel to The Chosen and the Beautiful from Nick's point of view, which is called Don't Sleep with the Dead. and there's a Bluebeard story coming up. And honestly, you know, it's, I just have a notebook full of things that I should be working on right now.
Oh, that's fabulous. Okay, you have to come back. Talk to us about all of them.
This has been so much fun.
Very nice. Nepo, the book is The Chosen the Beautiful. It is spectacular.
I'm so glad you liked it.
It's just, it's beautiful. And the cover is beautiful. Holding up for our viewers on News Channel 8.
Yeah, that's Greg Ruth. His art is fantastic.
Yeah, it's really beautiful. I can see, I read something you wrote about it. You said, as soon as you saw it, you knew that was it. So stay with us for a second. Mm-hmm. Claude, remind people what they should know about Patreon.
Absolutely. You want to become a Patreon member, patreon.com/chatteronbooks. We just did a segment, 60 seconds more. It was a little more than 60 seconds, but you didn't hear it on the show if you're listening now, because it's only for Patreon members. And by the way, the next show, next week, you'll be able to watch us do a show live. As Bill O'Reilly once said, we'll do it live. And
exactly.
Or it's screamed at an assistant. So.
Thank you, Claude. And we are back next week with Karen Tumulty, who is a longtime political journalist in town. Rock star, incredible person. And she is the author of The Triumph of Nancy Reagan. Don't gag. It's really good. I will read to you what Michael Beschloss said about it. And he said, the wonderful Karen Tumulty, and she is wonderful, has brought us a shrewd and fascinating portrait with new revelations and insights of a glittering and complex figure who is one of the most consequential women in American history. She's fabulous. So we're looking forward to that. But everybody, please listen to us, download us, review us, all those kinds of things you do. Ron Charles, thank you, my friend. So great to see you.
That's a pleasure.
David,
yes.
The Wizards, Nebo, spectacular to meet you, even by Zoom. Claude, thank you for doing all the important work. And everybody, stay healthy, and we will see you soon next week. We're out.